This is a difficult topic.
So why doesn't somebody try to...
So have you thought about it since this morning?
We have thought about it. We wrote down some questions, but my notes are misleading me, so I've just got to get back into
your notes are misleading you.
Yeah, it's not a good start.
They have a will of their own, free will, even your notes have a will of their
own. Okay, well, I think where the question started off earlier on was that whether or not it was ever bad to die. See, I think that was the point, wasn't it?
Whether it's ever bad to die? I thought we were going to talk about free will and karma.
No, but that led
oh, but that's what that led into it.
Yeah, and so...
Is it ever bad? I'm sure there's plenty of circumstances where it would be better to live than to die. But that's sort of off topic.
That's not... Is that... Well, so the topic started off that you said, who would want to stay in this body forever? I.e., it's... Sometimes you have responsibilities, and I said, well, sometimes you have responsibilities,
okay.
And sometimes when you die, it will be difficult circumstances. And you said, well, Krishna will arrange that, and then you've gone into the topic about free will and
okay.
Krishna's arrangement.
Okay. One thing is we should understand that there's different levels of consciousness. And according to the different levels of consciousness, there's different dharma. And the dharma at one level of consciousness makes no sense to the people in another level of consciousness. Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains this very nicely. But it's something like what I said earlier, that for children who are 6 years old, you tell them you have to subtract only a smaller number from a bigger number. That's their rule. And if you tell six-year-old children you can subtract a bigger number from a smaller number, they'll just become confused. So you don't tell them that. But at a higher level, you can talk about that. So what is dharma is different according to one's level of understanding. And if you try to mix the levels, you become very confused. If you say, well, but this is true at this level of understanding, so why isn't it true over here? But it's different.
Can you describe what dharma is exactly?
Well, ultimate dharma, of course, is to love Krishna. That's the dharma of the self. The dharma of the self is to be completely in love with Krishna. And then what you do when you're fully in love with Krishna flows naturally. There's no... When one is fully in prema bhakti, there's no rules anymore. There doesn't have to be. Rules are for people who don't have prema. So that's ultimate dharma. Then, to whatever extent you're lacking in prema, there has to be rules. But those rules change depending on how far you are. You know, if one is thinking that I'm this body, I am a, young Indian male living in London, then you have a certain dharma according to that sense of identity. But that's not ultimate dharma. That's to bring you to a higher level. So if someone's thinking like that, I mean, fully in that consciousness, then yes, you talk about you have this responsibility and you have this duty, and if you don't do this, people will suffer. And that's real on that level.
How about someone spiritually? Say if
spiritually, those things don't have any meaning.
No. As in, how about your parents, say? If you were, say you're quite an elevated devotee, if one was quite an elevated devotee, and he was about to pass away, and yet, for some reason, and how about his spiritual duty to his parents? Well, don't call it duty, he didn't have a spiritual obligation, it's an obligation, he wanted to help his parents spiritually. In that situation.
But there's so many ways to help people spiritually. You don't have to help people spiritually by being in physical proximity to them. See, you're mixing two totally different states of existence. If somebody is fully absorbed in Krishna prema, the way they manifest duty in this world, they don't have to manifest any duty in this world. They don't have any duty in this world. Do you have to do any duty in the prison?
But then,
do you have to do any duty in the prison?
Yeah, you don't. But then Krishna also said, I think, somewhere, that somebody, Prabhu, can't be completely stone-hearted, because people have affection. He said, while you mustn't be too attached, to also be too stone-hearted about it.
But you see, again, you're mixing levels. Tell me what level you want to talk about.
Well, on sort of an attainable level for the average devotee.
Then you talk about Varnashram Dharma, and you talk about Sadhana Bhakti.
But Krishna, I don't know what level it is, but Krishna said to surrender unto me, you can't be stone-hearted.
But someone who's in prana bhakti isn't stone hardened. They're overflowing with love. Constantly.
But even in the material sense, even they say you can't just reject your parents completely.
It may, but how somebody at that level, how that love manifests materially, will vary according to the individual. But you can't judge somebody at that level by the rules of a lower level. It doesn't work. You can't look at high-grade mathematics and judge it by year-one mathematics and say, well, they're not following the rules for year-one mathematics, so they must not understand numbers. It's nonsensical. Somebody who's at the level of prema bhakti, they're showing the greatest love for everybody, although that may not manifest the way that it would for an ordinary conditioned soul. It's not... I mean, Prabhupada took vanaprastha and left his family before one of his children was married. So from a material point of view, that's reprehensible. Prabhupada said it was a daughter. He said you cannot get free of the debt to get your daughter married. Prabhupada says that over and 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 over again. And he says the parents are responsible for their children until they get married. So why did Prabhupada do that? Was he socially negligent? So if we do that, we would be socially negligent, and we'd have a reaction for that. But it's sort of like, you know, you have a classroom and you have a teacher, so the children have to raise their hand, and my students would sometimes say, "Oh, Mother Emily, why don't you have to raise your hand?" It's not applicable. We've had a lot of admitted problems in the Hare Krishna movement that Prabhupada would sometimes speak on a very high level, and then people who aren't on that level would try to imitate that and cause havoc.
Then even Krishna said, he also said that there's a set of rules for everybody which you follow, no matter the level. So even if
no.
it was a demon,
the old, no. No, that's not true.
Whether it be demon or... If a demon, for example, Bali Maharaj, he was a demon,
yes.
But he followed the proper principles, so despite being it wasn't a separate, even though he wasn't on the same sort of status in one sense, because it was the same sort of rules, they had to be applied to everyone.
The basic rule is to love Krishna and not envy. That rule applies to everybody. But to what extent you realize that is going to depend on what rules you follow. It's absurd to impose the rules for the beginning stage on somebody who's constantly absorbed in Krishna's pastimes, who has no material mind and intelligence, and who's overflowing with love, who sees everyone spiritually, who's practically not even in the world. Yeah, you can't impose upon them the rules for a beginner. And nor can you have a beginner imitate the rules of such a person. So, you know, in Prabhupada's books, he speaks about all different levels. And one has to understand, okay, what applies to me? Does that make sense? You know, I see the problem is you're looking at something for the college professor and you're saying, well, wait, they're not following the rules for the year one students. Well, of course not. And the year one students can't act like a college professor. Is that at all? Yeah, it may appear that somebody at very high levels of saintliness is hard-hearted according to material estimation. It may look like that. Like it looks like the PhD in mathematics is breaking the six-year-old saying, well, you're breaking all the rules. I was taught that I can't do that. I used to teach my little kids to never start a sentence with the word because. If they do that, they'll write a fragment. They'll just say, because I like it, which isn't a complete sentence. So when they're 6 and 7, I make a rule. You can't start a sentence with the word because. And I teach them that as a rule. So if they look at some, you know, advanced writing, oh, there's a sentence starting with because, it's improper grammar. Is that?
Yeah,
so if you look at the activities of the Paramahansas, they may appear from a material point of view sometimes to be hard-hearted. And then the Paramahansas look at the ordinary conditioned souls and see their so-called love and affection is just lust and exploitation. You follow? You know? The little children write this beautiful poem, and they bring it home. Oh, Mommy, Daddy, I've written beautiful poetry. But compared to Shakespeare, it's trash. You follow? So the great souls who are swimming in genuine love, they look at ordinary people who are so-called being soft-hearted and loving and caring and giving, and they see it's all nonsense. It's all trash. But you can't just stop that, because then they'll become hard-hearted. If you just say to most people, you know, give up your affection for your family and friends, and then they'll just become mean and nasty.
It's like a natural progression.
Yes, it's a natural progression. And what appears to be righteous at one level does not necessarily look the same way at another level.
I can appreciate that.
Does that make some more sense?
Yeah,
you actually have to deal with people, thank you, at a lower level, taking into account that people are illusioned.
But I think when we were talking about it before, it wasn't simply about duty, but also the concept of free will and how that, because the duty then moved on to free will. So mm-hmm. it was solely about this point. And so.
Okay. There was also another question. Sorry, before we move on to that.
Okay. Is this all right with everybody? If you're objecting, say something. This is not. I'm not just talking to one or two people here. So I'm talking to all of you. So if there's something. You couldn't hear them, okay. I'll try to repeat questions.
Okay, so you know how you said about Krishna arranging things? I'm dreaming of the question of that, you know, someone feels they have duty towards their parents. And you said in the scripture that you said Krishna arranges, right? And if you want to draw that same example, Krishna may well have arranged something for them, but if they're at the crossroads stage of their life where they need to make a decision, they don't know what Krishna's arranged. So how do they actually go about with the decision?
You're saying Krishna's arranged everything, but if we don't know what Krishna's arranged, how do we make decisions?
Yeah,
is your question, how do we make decisions? Is that your question? Well, is that the essence of your question?
But, yeah, just to clarify though, yeah. Like, for example, like Krishna might have arranged, yeah, that if you, I don't know, go for brahmachari life, then someone is there to help your parents spiritually, or something like that, right?
Okay.
But you don't know that that's been arranged. So how do you just clarify that?
Is it a general question that how do you decide what you're going to do? Is that...
Yeah, in respect to what Krishna's arranged for you.
Okay. I still want to get... Is this a general question as to how do I make decisions in my life about what I should do?
I'm looking for the answer to clarify.
Okay, so...
Or are you interested in the very specific question that my parents are old and they have no one else to take care of them, can I move into the brahmachari ashram and will Krishna take care of them?
No.
That's a very specific question, which then we would deal with on an individual basis with an individual person.
It is decision making because everyone reaches crossroads in their life, right?
Okay, so when we come to places where we have choice, first of all, do we have choices at every moment?
Yes.
Okay. So, and how do we know what are the significant choices and what are the insignificant choices? So we might think, I'm kind of stepping back a bit, we might think that moving into the brahmachari ashram and neglecting my parents versus staying at home and taking care of my parents is a major life choice. And we might think that whether I'm sitting in the temple room right now or I'm hanging out outside is a very minor life choice. Have you ever had anything happen to you that was dependent on a very minor decision that you made? Like you decided to leave your house 10 minutes later than you had planned, and because of that, you met somebody who told you about a really good opportunity, and because of that, you got a scholarship, or because of that, you started a new business, or because of that, you met the person that you married, or something. Has anyone ever had something like that? You make a very, very tiny, tiny decision, like to answer the phone when you were walking out the door, or to stop and talk to somebody that you didn't know if you had time, and you thought, oh, I'm going to, or to stay home 5 minutes later, or leave home 5 minutes earlier, or get in a car on this side instead of that side. Very small decisions that ended up leading. Who has had an experience like that? So do we know what are the big decisions and what are the small decisions? That's my first question. No. We don't.
But how do How about if you had a frail elderly mother? And it's talking about
okay, but let's first say are we making decisions all the time?
Yes.
Okay. Do we know which of those decisions will have major consequences and which ones of those will have minor consequences? Do we? We think we do. Okay, we may think that we do. We may think, well, if I marry A instead of B, that will make a huge difference in my life. Maybe your life would turn out almost identically. You don't know that. And sometimes, you know, leaving the house 5 minutes early has your life make a huge turn. Am I correct in this? Just let's first. You don't want to admit that.
You can say, how about the decision to step off a building or not step off a building? There's like 99.
Okay, there are certain things, obviously.
But then how about to
decide, do I want to shoot you or not? I mean, obviously that's a major decision. Okay, but. But in general in life, other than doing something very extreme, I don't think any of us are going to jump off buildings or shoot anybody, okay? But other than very, very extreme examples, it's not possible to tell. It just isn't. Okay, so let's just first settle that. That to know what are the major decisions and what are not, I mean, my mother was very sick, and she wanted to move into an elderly home. And at that particular juncture, I wasn't obligated in any other way. And I thought, okay, what's my duty? I said, Mom, if you want, I will stay with you in your house, and that way you don't have to move into the home. And I realized that saying that might obligate me to be with her for 15 years. She refused. She moved into the home. She died a year later. I ended up spending the last 3 weeks with her. But, okay, I made a decision that I was willing to be with her. The consequences of that decision for me were nil. As far as practical outward things, I mean, it had a nice consequence in my heart that I made that. I mean, I really sat and I prayed about it. And, I considered what it said in the Shastra, and I thought, this is my duty, and I made that offer. I wrote her a long letter, I'm willing to do this. And I understood, you know, what does that mean? That I would do this. But the actual consequences of that decision didn't exist. They were nothing.
But was that dharma based on love of Krishna?
Well, wait a minute.
Sorry.
Okay, can we just settle this? First point.
But it's all your consciousness.
Yeah, just first point. Do we know what decisions are major and what decisions are not? No. Okay. Got that. Are we making decisions at every moment?
Yes.
Okay. What are the basis under which we should make decisions? That's the question. Yeah, some idea.
The consequences of whatever actions.
The consequences of our actions. All right. Do we know the consequences of our actions? We can make a good guess. Are we right all the time? No. Are we sometimes extremely wrong? Are the consequences sometimes exactly the opposite? And Prahlad Maharaj says that in the Bhagavatam. He says the consequences are sometimes the opposite of what you intend. You do something to try to help somebody and they're offended. You do something to try to offend somebody and they're happy, you know? I mean, life is funny. You do something to try to make money and you lose all your money. You don't care about getting money and you get money. You do something to be healthy, it makes you sicker. I mean, these things happen, right? So that's a tough one. The consequences. You can say your hoped for consequences, reasonable consequences. You know, we've come here with a reasonable consequence of being spiritually enlightened. The bus could have crashed, we could have ended up being, who knows? I mean, how do you know? You come here and commit an offense and be spiritually enlightened. But okay, the reasonable consequences. According to our experience. What are we based that on? How do we decide what's a reasonable consequence? Based on our experience, which is limited. And not only is our experience limited, but it's not really based on our experience, it's based on how we've interpreted our experience. Isn't it? Mm. You ever seen somebody in what looks like a nice situation who's miserable with it? Mm. Or people who are in what looks like a miserable situation who are happy with it? So it's not just our experience, it's how we've chosen to add, to put meaning on our experience. Okay, so we're making decisions based on how we choose to interpret our experiences, which are limited. How else do we decide the probable consequences?
Advice
we're given by others. Sometimes we get good advice and sometimes we get lousy advice. I've been given some pretty lousy advice in my life. Yeah?
And whether we choose to follow that advice or not is another
thing. Right, okay. Whether we choose to follow that advice, what else?
So this is another advert, but at some point in today's talk, can you also help us?
Yeah, I'm trying to get you there step by step.
No, choose like whether or not, like, whose advice you can take.
Oh, that's whose advice you can take. That's so individual.
No, but like generally,
all right, we'll try. You're trying to get like blanket, foolproof. What are we really asking? You want to know what you're really asking? You're really asking, how can I make decisions so I'll always be happy and nothing bad will ever happen to me? That's really what you're asking. Guess what the answer to that is? You can't do that materially. Sorry, I'm really sorry. It's not going to work. That's the essence. No, you can talk, but that's really the crux of it. How can I make decisions so that I'll never suffer? There is an answer to that, but it's not on the material platform. If every decision we make is full of Krishna prema, then there's no suffering, even if externally you're suffering. So externally, you know, everybody's yelling at you, or externally, you know, you got tortured or something, and you're in bliss. Haridas Thakur is being beaten, and he's in ecstasy. He made a decision to keep chanting, even though the Muslim rulers told him to be quiet. And he was being beaten. Somebody else would have died, and he was floating in a sea of unlimited ecstasy. So if you want to know how to always make decisions so that you'll always be happy, that's the answer. But how do we get there is another question. But anyway, let's go back a little bit. So, okay, we listen, we take other people's advice. How else do we make decisions? Where does that come from? Yeah, but where does that come from? Okay, so the things that people have taught you, principles of right and wrong, what's good and what's bad. So we've all been trained when we were little that if you shoot somebody, you'll probably be unhappy. So and maybe sometime we've been tempted to do that, but we don't do it. So, okay, we've been taught something, or we've been tempted to steal, and we haven't done it. You know, we see something, oh, I'd like that. No, if I take that, I'll suffer. Or maybe we were a little kid and we did take something and we suffered and we learned. So experience, advice, what we've been taught. Yeah.
What we learned from Shastra.
That's really the biggest. Of course, does Shastra have specific decisions for everything? Does it say in Shastra when to leave your house to go shopping? Does it say for a particular individual if they should get married or not? Does it say for a particular individual who you should marry? Does it tell you what specific company to work for? What specific country to live in? People also think this way with guru. They think, well, I'll go to my guru. And I see a lot of people have faith problems because of this. And they think, my guru should tell me what city to live in, what specific thing to do 24 hours a day, you know, who to marry, what to name my kids, what I should eat for breakfast. And if I follow that, then I'll never be unhappy, materially speaking. People think like that. They think, does that work? No. You know, on a material level, there isn't some formula like that. And there isn't some specific, you know, there's a lot of specific things. There isn't something specific for everything. You know, do I wear the dhoti with the blue border or the dhoti with the red border today? I mean, there's nothing like that in Shastra. But our main guide is Shastra. Now, of course, when we're approaching Shastra, we're also to some extent understanding it through our experience, we're to some extent understanding it through our regular instructions, we're to some extent understanding it through the advice from others, yes?
The likes and dislikes, you might choose not to be focused
on. Oh yeah, definitely. That's the mind. So the mind is basically saying, you know, is accepting and rejecting, and is it doing it? So we want to follow Shastra. That's the big key. Yeah?
Would you have a path of truth and untruthful? Would you have like a path, for example, like in which path you'll go to, for example, I think?
A choice between truth and untruth?
Yes.
Okay, but What is truth and what is untruth depends on the situation.
The path of happiness and the path of wherever you...
The only path of happiness is Krishna Prem, and the only ultimate path of truth is love for Krishna.
Okay.
All other paths are ultimately untruth. But if you go down to a lower level, then you start looking at other things.
Yeah.
You know, do I tell the customer the price I paid for this or not?
No, you don't make a decision.
You see what I'm saying? If I'm running a business and I tell the customer the price I paid for it, then I may not make any business. So what is the path of truth there? The path of truth there is the truth according to my occupation, not an absolute standard of truth. So you see some lady, she has a little baby and the baby looks like a piglet. I've used this example before because I know one devotee who had a baby who really looked like a little pig. So I'm not going to go up to him and say, oh, Hari Prabhu, look at the little piglet. So the path of truth is not, you know, that may depend on circumstances.
And would you get knowledge? Because as intellectual, the knowledge also from other people who advise people.
Well, yeah.
When the people give you advices, you get the knowledge that, look, I've got a good piece of work, for example.
But is the knowledge you get from other people always reliable?
Possibly.
Always.
Sometimes, I don't know.
Well, sometimes. The advice you get from other people is subjected to their interpreted experiences. But we have Shastra, we have Guru, we have Sadhu as a general guide. So as far as taking care of old parents, we know that the general guide, Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, the children are supposed to take care of their parents. So generally speaking, that's the dharmic thing to do, which will lead us to material happiness and please Krishna. I mean, that's simple.
It will please Krishna as well as material. There's a material motive. And
unless you're on a different level, in which case you may be operating differently. But for generally speaking, yes.
So, can I just clarify something?
So, all right, there you are taking care of your old parents, and you've gone out that day to get some milk to take care of your mother, and on the way to get some milk, the car has hit you head on, right? And your skull is cracked, and every bone in your body is broken, and you're lying there in the hospital, and you're going to say, Krishna, please help me live so I can take care of my mother.
But it was more a basis on duty. It wasn't to do with every single individual choice. It was more to do with a big problem, which could potentially, you said that in some circumstances, you could kind of foresee the outcome. But then you should work based on duty.
The way you understand the outcome is primarily from Shastra. Because if we try to understand the outcome just with our senses, are we as likely to be wrong as right? So we make decisions as far as possible based on Shastra. I mean, Shastra doesn't tell you whether you know, how much halva you should eat or something like that.
Okay. So you're saying that basically we're all trying to aim to get to Krishna consciousness and to have the full love of Krishna. And so all of our decisions will be based around that.
All right, yes. And I mean, what the guru does tell you is what level of dharma applies to your particular case. I mean, it's not that by following the instructions of the guru or by even Krishna personally comes and talks to you, it's not that your whole life materially is going to be beautiful.
Well, they say that you can't have true happiness in a material existence. I think in the first canto.
It's not possible.
It's not possible. So that means everything has to...
You can have true happiness in the material world if your consciousness is in love with Krishna.
Right.
But you can't have true happiness in the material world in a materialistic consciousness. It's a contradictory thing. You know, how happy can you be in prison? In chains, you know, it's like... What kind of happiness and freedom can you have in that situation, materially speaking? You can't. You could be spiritually happy there, but you couldn't be materially happy there.
So when you made your decision, was that based on going towards Krishna consciousness, or was that based on...
Well, if you're following Guru and Shastra, then you're going towards Krishna. And Guru tells you at what level each individual should understand and apply the Shastra, because there's instructions in the Shastra for different levels. So Guru says to you, you're at year one level, so this is your instruction, and says, you know, you're already in graduate school spiritually, so this is your instruction. Guru teaches us how to apply the Shastra to our own life, and of course we also see the examples of the sadhus. How do they apply the Shastra? We have to be careful because some sadhus are applying the Shastra at a higher or lower level than we ought to be doing.
Does that mean material considerations are more important if you're lower down?
Yes, exactly. The lower down you are in consciousness, the more you are concerned with material obligations and material circumstances.
I don't know anything.
So, you know, don't be falsely humble. Okay. So just like, you know, if you're a poet, if you're a very advanced poet, you're not very concerned with rules of grammar. Correct? Mm-hmm. Right? Something like that. And the lower you are in the level of learning English, the more you have to be very concerned with the rules of grammar. Or if you're a very expert musician, you know, you can improvise. When you're beginning, you're taking someone else's work and you're just reading their music. The same rules don't apply. So yeah, the more beginner you are, the more that you have to follow a certain formula, the more you're going to be interested in externals. Somebody very advanced may follow all the externals, but they're not doing it for their own, out of their own necessity. They're doing it for some other reason. They're doing it to teach somebody else. So if I'm teaching somebody beginning reading, though I may be saying, okay, rat. I don't read like that. But to teach somebody, I may do that. And the child may think, oh, the teacher is also reading like that. So very advanced souls may behave as if they're interested in material considerations. Is that okay? Somebody else have something because we don't want to make sure yet.
Free will and Krishna's already knowing the previous. How much free will do we actually have if Krishna already knows what decision we're going to make and he knows everything?
Isn't that that was what I wanted to really focus on? Are you at least reasonably satisfied? Okay. I mean, at least like 30-40%? Okay. Are you at least 30-40% satisfied? Okay. So I'll tell you how I think about this. Do you all know the story in the Mahabharata of Gandhari?
Yes.
Okay. Who knows the story of Gandhari benedicting her son Duryodhana at the end of the battle? Who knows that story? Okay, so Gandhari married a blind man, and she decided that she didn't want her husband to feel that she was superior to him. So she put a blindfold around her eyes as soon as she learned she was going to marry him. She thought, I want to take up the same mood as my husband, and she lived her whole life as if she were blind. And she did that in a very happy mood. Nobody told her to do it, nobody forced her to do it, it was voluntary, and it was happy. And because she did that, she pleased the Lord, and therefore he gave her some potency. We don't get power and potency from the things themselves. We get power and potency from pleasing Krishna. So Krishna was happy with her, that she had given up her own enjoyment for the sake of serving. So there was this big battle between her son, she had a lot of children, and between their cousins, her sons and her son's cousins. And all of her children were killed except for the eldest, Duryodhana. So she was heartbroken that all of her sons, except one, and her grandsons had been killed in the battle, even though they were in the wrong, and she knew they were in the wrong, but still she loved her children. Mothers are. Mothers love even condemned murderers if they're their children. Just the nature. So she was very much in love with her son, Duryodhana, and she gave him a very interesting instruction. Does anyone know what instruction she gave him? Yeah. Yes, she said. She said, "Go take a bath and come to see me without wearing any clothes." So, obviously, when we're babies, our mothers see us all the time without clothes. But once we're adults, it's a little odd to come in front of your mother without any clothes. So, but he's thinking, you know, in those days, if the mother gave an instruction, you followed the instruction. So he said, "Well, it's a rather peculiar instruction, but it's coming from my mother." And so, all right, I'll do it. So as he's walking naked to go see his mother, Krishna sees him, and Krishna says, what are you doing? Now, you see somebody walking naked on the property, What are you doing? He says, what are you doing? He says, well, my mother told me to come see you without clothes. And he said, well, that's not very proper. He said, why don't you just take like a big leaf and tie it around yourself so a leaf is not clothes, and that way you'll be following your instructions, but you won't be indecent. So Duryodhan thought about it, and he thought, okay, well, that sounds good. He must have been feeling a little uncomfortable with the situation. Anyway. So he comes in front of his mother, and she says, have you come without clothes? And he says, yes. So then what did she do? She took off her blindfold, and because of her austerities, she had the power that what she willed would come to pass. And her will was, it's interesting what she willed. She didn't will that her son would not die, and she didn't will that her son would not be defeated. Her will was, my son will have a body that's made of iron, that whenever I look at him, his body will become like iron. But, of course, she couldn't see right here, which also covered the tops of his thighs. And then when she looked, she said, oh, why have you covered any portion of your body? He said, well, I didn't want to come in front of you naked. And then she can understand that she wasn't going to be able to prevent his death. Okay, now let's go back a few years. So a few years previous to this, the same son, Duryodhan, he had challenged his cousins to a game of dice. And he had been cheating. And they lost everything. And finally, after they lost everything, he said, you have one more thing to gamble, and that is your wife. He said, you can gamble your wife. So only a crazy person can gamble their wife. But Yudhisthira had become so mad from gambling that he said, all right, I'll stake my wife. So they bring out Draupadi. And what did Duryodhan say to her?
Lagman's blind son.
He said, oh, please sit on my lap.
He said, Lagman's blind son, and then he said...
No, to Draupadi at that time. Sit on my lap.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. He said, please sit on my lap. And when he said that, what did Bhima do?
I'm going to break your
thigh. I'm going to break your thigh. Okay, so we have, some people have exercised their free will. Bhima exercised his free will that he said, I'm going to break your thigh. Did he have to say that? No, he chose to say that. So Gandhari exercised her free will in that she was trying to protect her son. Okay? So what happened? Everything was protected against his thigh, and except his thigh, and Bhima was able to kill him by smashing his thigh. So Krishna wanted Duryodhan to be killed because he was a big problem. So Krishna wanted him to be killed. But you see that Krishna respected Bhima's desire to break Duryodhan's thigh, and Gandhari's desire to give a benediction to her son. So both of those desires were respected. Krishna didn't interfere with either of those desires. And his will still happened. So that to me is a very nice example. I think of it just like, you know, if you have a big hill, and on the hill there's many rocks, and the water's pouring on the hill, and the water's going to go where? Down. And what happens when it gets to a rock? Around it, or... over it, or under it, or all of the above. Does the water get stopped from going downhill by a rock? Suppose it's a really big rock. It takes some more. Maybe it goes over the top and you have a waterfall. Okay. So Krishna, so I don't know how he does this. If you want to know how he does this, I do not have that answer for you. Okay? I don't know how he does it. I think it's amazing that he does it. When I was running a school program, at one point I had 30 students ages 5 to 17 all in one room that I was teaching. And I had to keep track of each of these students. Each one of them was doing something different than the others. And I had to keep track of what everybody was doing, and it was not an easy thing to do. And every once in a while I'd miss something. You know, a kid would think, oh, maybe she won't notice if I don't turn in this assignment. And sometimes I'd actually miss it. Because that's just 30 people for, you know, 6 hours a day. And sometimes you look around and the kid's not in the room and you're, oh, where did Ananda go? You know, and she's been out doing who knows what for the last 10 minutes before you find her. So I have a very difficult time coordinating the schedules of 30 people. And Krishna's coordinating the desires of billions and billions and billions and billions and billions and billions of living entities. I have no idea how he does that. He does that in his sleep, quite literally. And still his overall plans take place. That Krishna's able to weave together all of our desires. We can do whatever we want with, we have certain constraints by our past karma, And so Krishna's overall plan takes place. I don't understand that Krishna has like a specific detailed plan, except in rare instances.
So basically our free will is minus his grand plan.
Yeah.
Whatever we decide, whatever is meant to happen.
The grand plan's going to happen anyway, but we think ourselves very, very important. We think that our decisions are very momentous. You know, I mean, it sometimes appears that way. It appears that a certain person is very instrumental for good or for bad in history. But Krishna's not dependent on it. Like I said, I mean, if Krishna wants to kill 20,000 people or, you know, millions of people, he doesn't require a terrorist to go into a building. He doesn't require Hitler. I mean, Krishna's perfectly capable of... And Krishna doesn't require a humanitarian to save millions of people's lives either. Krishna can save millions of people's lives without a humanitarian, and he can kill millions of people without a demon. I mean, he's not limited by that. But if somebody wants to be humanitarian, then Krishna puts them in touch with people who should be saved. And if somebody wants to be a demon, Krishna puts them in touch with people who should be killed. Okay, fine. We exercise our free will within boundaries. Who's the person who's affected by the exercise of our free will? Krishna. Ourselves. Only. Now that we're talking materially, we're not talking spiritually. We're talking on a material level. The only person you're affecting by your decisions materially is yourself. That's all. So the reason that we're supposed to try to help people is to benefit ourselves, and the reason we're not supposed to hurt people is to avoid hurting ourselves, and that's all. We do not have the, we can't, everyone has a jail sentence here. We don't have the power to change somebody's jail sentence. Again, I'm speaking materially, I'm not speaking spiritually. Spiritually, that's all, I'll get to that in a minute. That's another level. We can change things on the spiritual level. We cannot change things on a material level. So if I see that someone's hurt and I go to help them, why should I go to help them? Why? Why should I develop compassion? Who am I benefiting? Am I really benefiting the person I'm going to help? I'm benefiting myself. I'm benefiting myself. It doesn't mean I just don't do anything. I say, well, I can't affect anybody anyway, I won't do anything. Then who are you going to hurt? Yourself. Does that make sense? Does that make sense? Okay. If I just say, well, everybody's just acting according to their karma, and I can neither hurt anybody nor help anybody other than what they deserve, but I'm still a materialistic consciousness. I'm not transcendental. And I just say, well, I won't interact with anybody. I will hurt myself. If you're driving on the road and you see someone's got into an accident and they're bleeding to death and you just drive by and say, well, hey, that's their karma. I can't do anything. You're going to harden your heart. You're going to hurt yourself. You're going to damage your own advancement. I mean, the same way, you know, if you go up to somebody and you start screaming and yelling at them and hitting them, you're going to damage yourself. You can't go around beating people up and saying, well, it was their karma anyway. I mean, you can say that, but, you know, the result will not be very pleasant for you. So we do have injunctions. Don't hurt people and do good to others. Because whatever we do to others is what's going to come back to us. However we interact with other living beings is what we're going to experience. And whatever we're experiencing is what we've put out. If we don't like what we're getting back, we ought to change what we're putting out. This is on a material level. So on the material level, we generally think, my doing X is hurting somebody, and my doing X is helping somebody, and we probably need to think like that or we wouldn't do anything. So in general, we do say to people, yes, if you help the accident victim, you are actually helping them. If you hurt somebody, you are actually hurting them. You have damaged them, and you're responsible. You're going to have to suffer because you're responsible. And we speak in those terms. From a higher level, that's all nonsense. But it, from the level of material consciousness, that's real. All right? Okay? I'm sitting down with children who are playing, and when I'm sitting down with children who are playing, I say, oh, I don't know, you know, if you put the fire truck over there, it's not going to be very good. Okay? I don't go to a child who's playing and say, yeah, this is all nonsense. Why are you playing? Now, on a spiritual level, you can actually affect people. Then it's a different set of laws. And you can change people's karma if you deal with them spiritually. And there you are dealing with that Krishna's will follows the will of the devotee. So there's the opposite scenario. Krishna's neutral in his dealing with the material world as Paramatma. He's neutral. He doesn't favor anybody. He doesn't neglect anybody. It's all law. Everything's happening according to law. And Krishna does not interfere. Krishna doesn't just like whimsically hand out spiritual realization to people. He doesn't, you know, say, oh, I think I'm just going to give this person transcendence and I'm not going to give this person transcendence. He's neutral. But the devotees, Prabhupada says the devotees are more merciful than the Lord in a sense. Devotees will take the mood that, let me see who's receptive. I mean, sometimes an Uttama Bhakta just gives Krishna consciousness to everybody. But generally the devotees take the mood of what we call the Majjhima Bhakta. And they say, let me see who's receptive. Let me see who's interested. Ravindasarupa was talking about this when he was traveling one time with Jamal Krishna Maharaj and Vishnu Janan Swami. So he said, Jamal Krishna Maharaj told me as a formula that they would have a bhajan and distribute prasadam. And then he would walk around the crowd and say, do you like the music? Do you like the food? And if someone said yes, then he'd sit and preach to them. If they said no, he would go on to the next person. He was judging, are they receptive? So Ravindasarupa decided he would test this. So he went up to someone, you know, do you like the music? Answer. Do you like the food? Answer. And then he spent like 2 hours preaching to the person. At the end, the person said, everything you said is right, but I'm going to go on with my life. So the devotee is at the middle level is discriminating. This person is so demoniac that there's no use in dealing with them. You know, this person is a devotee. I can talk to them about Krishna. And this person is innocent and receptive. And it's explained in Nectar Devotion that if a devotee just has the desire, I wish this person would get love of God, then Krishna's desire follows the desire of the devotee. And that way, people are given the opportunity, at least, to get love of God. In which case, yes, their karma does change. And you really do affect people. And by not giving people Krishna, you hurt them. And by giving Krishna to people, you actually help them. And in that sense, we have a lot of power to change the face of reality and to change fate. But otherwise, if we're just acting within the material laws, the only thing we have the power to do is affect our own situation. And really. We really don't, we just don't have the power to change somebody else's karma. There's a few demigods that can sometimes mess around with people's karma. Although sometimes we get in trouble for that. Sometimes Krishna calls them to task. Why are you doing this? But we can't do it. Does that help? Yeah.
I have a question.
Yeah, of course it's okay.
So, go back to the original point. In Bhagavad Gita chapter 7, when Krishna says he knows the future. So, basically, if we are exercising free will, which means we're creating the future, then...
He knows it as we're creating it moment to moment. Future's changing moment to moment. Some things are fixed. There are some things fixed, but not all details. Prabhupada gives that example when Prabhupada's asked this many times. And he says someone's walking along the road and he sees somebody on a tree limb. He's sitting on the tree limb and he's sawing the limb off the tree. And he says, if you do that, you'll fall. And then the man falls and he said, oh, you're a great fortune teller. And Prabhupada says, Krishna knows the future like that. He knows if you're doing this, this is what will happen. But we're creating the future moment by moment by moment, and Krishna sees that future as it's created. Kind of, you know, like you're weaving something, you're making something, and as you're creating it, it's taking shape. And Krishna can see how it's taking shape into the future. Some things are fixed. There are certain things that are fixed. There's certain incarnations that are going to appear at certain times, and certain people are going to appear to be their mother and father, and so certain circumstances are fixed no matter what we do. But that's very limited. It's not that everything is just fixed and we're a bunch of robots just kind of moving through space and time towards a predestined every detail. Then we're not a living being. And then there's no meaning to karma. And again, how does he do that? How does Krishna take a future that's developing moment by moment on the actions of billions of living entities and weave it together into a pattern that generally goes in a certain direction? I have no idea. I can tell you that he does it. But how does he do it? Pretty cool. And if anything, he does that in his sleep. It's not like while he's, you know, dancing with Radharani that he's thinking, oh, Mr. Joe Blow on planet 27 in universe 30 has got to, you know, break his toe today. It's not, he's not absorbed in that level of thing. Yeah.
I'm saying that he only knows it from moment to moment. Isn't that sort of limiting Krishna in that?
But the future only exists in that way.
Future only exists moment to moment. There's no way of foretelling the future.
But it only exists moment. It exists dependent on people's actions. You want Krishna to have your whole future planned out, so you just, you know, you have no free will? Is that what you want?
That's not what I want, but it sort of contradicts itself in that way, because that's like saying that there is definitely going to be a future. But if he doesn't know how it's planned out, so it sort of limits him in that sort of manner.
No, he's just a dynamic person.
Even to every detail, being the ultimate...
But then how would you behave? It makes no sense, then your actions would be meaningless.
So you
decided that either your actions are meaningless or God is meaningless. You're putting a false choice. It's a false choice. You're saying either what I do has no meaning because God has to know every single detail of what's going to happen forever. In which case, then all the supposed actions of all living beings are totally meaningless. And totally unfair also. It would mean that there's no meaning to the law of karma. So you'd be violating a huge portion of the scripture. Or you're saying, if karma is true, and we have the ability to shape our future through our actions and desires, then God isn't all-knowing. But why? You're defining all-knowing in a way that's not necessary. You're putting your own definition of all-knowing and knowing the future. That's like I was saying, it's not our experiences, it's how we interpret our experiences. You're interpreting the words all-knowing, and you're interpreting the words knowing the future to mean that it's just a scripted play. And we're just following a scripted play. So the person who just got their arm blown off, you know, in Lebanon, that had nothing to do with their actions, that's just Krishna planned, or Krishna forced them to do the actions to have their arm blown off. So that doesn't appeal to me very much.
It still troubles me that saying something is unlimited would mean that they have no limitation. You can't say that they wouldn't know what's going to happen.
He does know what's going to happen, but what's going to happen is changing moment by moment, and he knows it as it's changing moment by moment.
So he only knows it's that moment, because things will change.
But that's all there is to know.
Because
you want him to be all-knowing about something that there isn't to know. He does know. Yes, he does. And as it's changing, he always knows what it is. Okay, so you have an itinerary, all right? You're going to travel somewhere, and then you change your plans. You let me know, and then you change your plans, and you let me know. So I always know what you're doing. I always know where you're going.
You already know that those changes are going to take place.
Maybe. That depends. There's certain people that you may say, you know, I know this person, and this person is going to make such and such choices if presented with these alternatives. But that isn't always the case. Sometimes we may know someone very well, and under certain circumstances we can say, presented with these choices, this person will choose A. You know, I know Sam, and Sam likes vanilla, and if he's given a choice between vanilla and strawberry, he doesn't like strawberry, he'll choose vanilla. What we're choosing also is depending on what's happening to us. As different things happen to me, I become a different person in terms of what I choose. Right? Don't you have some choice as to how you react to things? Otherwise, how can you move between the modes of nature? And you'd be an awfully sadistic God who just, you know, had everything all planned out and you're not being forced to do that. I mean, Prabhupada specifically said, he said, Krishna knows the future like that. Like you see somebody falling off a branch and you know they're going to fall down. And they said, well, if anybody can know that, Prabhupada. He said, well, if anybody can know that, why can't Krishna know it? But what Krishna knows is much more complicated. All of us right now are on each of us is on a particular trajectory, all right? As long as we continue on that particular trajectory, we're going to go at a particular place, and Krishna knows that. You can also choose. So if you choose to change your path, then the things shift.
And Krishna knows the new path that we feel.
Uh-huh. I mean, there are extreme things. For each of us, Krishna certainly knows what would cause us to leave him. He could put a temptation in the front of any of us because he knows what our weaknesses are. Much better than we do. So certain things, yes. But Krishna's giving us an opportunity all the time to make good choices. You can't say, well, if I make a bad choice, well, you know, I was forced to, I had to. There was no option. Yeah.
Does he know, because if you're on a particular path, as soon as you choose that particular path, he instantly knows how, what the conclusion is going to be. Does he know every single particular juncture?
Maybe not. I mean, again, let's say you're training someone. What's something that you're good at that you know well? Pick something. Okay. So let's say you're training a beginning student in math. Do you have a very good idea of the overall path they're going to take to get from where they are now to where you are? Yeah. And you can look at the steps and you can say, you can even plan it out to a very large extent. On this day, we're going to teach this, and on this day, we're going to teach this. And if there's certain mistakes that a student will make, and you can see that if they keep making those mistakes, they're going to end up in a certain kind of trouble. And then there's certain things they understand, that if they understand that, you can often project quite a ways into the future, that if they keep going this way, then they'll understand this. If they keep going this way, they'll have difficulty. So why can't Krishna do that, like multiplied by about a billion, in terms of complexity and depth of understanding? And if all of a sudden your student decides to get really, really serious about the subject, says, I'm really going to apply myself. Oh, now I've changed my trajectory. Now this is what's going to happen. Otherwise, why is Krishna saying to Arjuna twice in Bhagavad Gita, you know, if you follow my instructions, this will happen, and if you don't follow my instructions, you'll be lost? There's a choice. There's a real choice. There's genuine choices between the modes. You know, you can choose to go to the horror section of the bookstore, or the romance section of the bookstore, or the philosophy section of the bookstore. Then you pick up a book. Now, if I've written the book, you start reading the philosophy book, I can tell you what you're going to go through as you read that book. You've chosen the book. I can say, this is how it ends. And I can even predict the different emotional responses you're going to have as you go through the book. But you could decide in the middle of the book to put it down and go to another section of the bookstore. Does that make sense?
So basically, he knows all of the paths.
Yes, he knows all the different... Did you ever see those Choose Your Own Adventure books? Do they have those?
Yeah.
So there's all the paths, and you can, you know, go different ways. So yeah, he knows all the paths. He knows all of the things. Yeah.
if Krishna knows, I don't understand why, if he knows everything and he knows every single path we're going to take, how that...
He doesn't know every path you're going to take.
The way I understand,
he knows the path you're taking, and he can see that the path you're taking, where that's going to go. If you shift paths, then he sees where that's going to go.
The way I understood it is that he knows every single path that we're going to take, but that doesn't mean that we're being forced into it. It's just like a child, you know, there's a plane there, and you know the kid so well that you know he's going to try and put his hand in it. But in the same way, God knows us so well that he knows what path we're going to take, but he's not forcing us, just like the man isn't forcing the kid.
You could say that. You could explain it that way. That's not a wrong way to explain it. But even what we're going to take is not static. That's not fixed for all eternity.
I mean, but he would know it, but we still have free will.
So if you have free will, that means that you can change your general inclination.
So we can change it, but it doesn't mean that just because we can do what we want, it doesn't mean that Krishna doesn't know what we want.
That's okay. If that's a way of understanding it, that works for you. That's all certainly okay. To say that Krishna knows the choices that we're going to make, but that knowing the choices we're going to make is changing moment by moment. Yes.
I was going to say in that verse someone quoted about how Krishna knows past, present, and future. In the second half of that verse, he says, "I also know all living beings." And I always understood that to mean just the time.
Just the same thing that he's saying.
Because I don't understand why if Krishna knows everything for all time, for eternity, how that and our free will, why are those mutually exclusive? I don't understand. Why can they not act together?
All right, that's fine. They do. That's the whole discussion here, that they do.
So I think you say, for example, does Krishna know from now what I'm going to do in 20 years' time?
Maybe. Some of that depends on you. Why? Okay, just like there is astrology. So if you're totally under the laws of nature, a really good astrologer could look at your chart and look at your palm and say, this is exactly what's going to happen to you in 40 years' time. About some things. But some things you're deciding in this life. Well, nowadays. But they can tell you some things, but not everything. If you go now to lunch and you overeat and you'll get a stomachache, that's not, you know, in your chart. You see, and it's not that so Krishna knows you're going to overeat, you know, 40 years ago. Yes, so that can also change. But some people's destiny is also more fixed than others. Like for some crimes, you get a mandatory jail sentence of 20 years. For some crimes, the judge has a lot of leeway how to enforce it. And for some crimes, the judge will say, if you do this, then you can be excused early. And some, you know, preacher goes into prison and preaches to you, and you reform yourself. And so then things change. And when a person went into jail, you'd say, okay, they're going to stay there for 20 years, but then it changes. So even astrologically, there's some things that are fixed and some things that are not fixed. Not everything is fixed. I mean, Prabhupada specifically said, Krishna knows the future like that. Very clearly, he didn't say Krishna knows the future, that every single detail of every single person's life is known for all of eternity. As if it was all a pre-designed thing. That Krishna knows exactly what we're going to choose 5 zillion quadrillion lifetimes from now. That's not how Prabhupada explains it. On an immediate level, I'd say yes. But that changes. The way that I make decisions now is not the way I made decisions 20 years ago. And that changes in response to my will. And I mean, don't you see that you have more than one way of responding to something? Is any, do any of you have a nature that's so fixed that you always respond to something in a particular way? Is anybody like that? Are you like that? Will you always respond, then you're a machine. Would you always respond to the same stimulus with the same response?
But then what you're saying is that in that verse, Krishna was essentially saying by the past, present, and immediate future.
There's long-term future that's existing right now, but that long-term future is in constant flux. Immediate future is in constant flux. It's in constant flux.
And he knows it within.
Why not? Why in the world not? I know my itinerary. So, then it changes and you know it. I know my itinerary for this summer. Okay, I can tell you what my itinerary is for this summer. But some people are talking about inviting me to some other place. And then when it changes, I'll know it. So I'm always in knowledge of my... Let's say that, you know, that nothing unusual is going to happen. It's just an example. So I always know what I'm going to be doing for the next 4 months. Let's say I had planned out my days for the next 4 months down to the 5 minutes. I always know it. As I change it, I know it. I never have any time I'm not knowing it. Why can't Krishna know the future for zillions and zillions and billions of years as it's constantly changing? He always knows it.
At one point, he thought it was vague, and then he was wrong.
Not that he's wrong. It's always right.
Yeah, but it changed. That means that...
Then it changes to something else that's right.
That means his initial guess wasn't...
It's not a guess. It's not a guess.
It's calculated.
It's always correct.
If you carry on in that way.
If you carry on in that way, that's what it is. It's always correct.
But surely at one point he maintained it would be one thing.
Based on what he remembered, if the information is
very
changing, then
he doesn't know what's going to go on afterwards. Based on what's going on.
No. He always knows the full picture, and the full picture is always changing. He always knows it as it's always changing.
But he doesn't know what's going to go on next.
Yes, he knows exactly what's going to go on next.
Surely he would know what the outcome's going to be.
What's going to go on next. Yeah.
I'm just going to say, I think the Lord is really, really smart, way smarter than we are.
Exactly,
and I think that at every given moment, he knows what the future is, and as it changes, he knows it's changing, and...
And he knows that, I believe, it's beyond us.
I don't know, I mean, I think...
Yes,
I think,
to some extent
maybe,
it is.
Maybe we've just been programmed... to think in a certain way, but so right now at this very second he knows what's happening, and then the very next second he suddenly knows everything that's going to happen again, and so it keeps changing, but he can keep with that.
Well, Prabhupada also says that Krishna himself is always expanding. He said Krishna expands, then his knowledge expands of himself, then he expands, then his knowledge of himself expands, then he expands, then his knowledge of himself expands. Or like there's because Krishna is unlimited not only in space but also in time. Or just like, when Krishna looks at Radharani, she becomes very happy, and happy people become more beautiful, right? I mean, women are happy on their wedding day not just because they have fancy hair and makeup, but because they're very happy. So when Krishna looks at Radharani, she becomes very happy, and when she's happy, she becomes more beautiful. And as Krishna sees that she becomes more beautiful, he becomes very happy, and he becomes more beautiful. And it goes on like that forever. So if you say, if he's already unlimitedly beautiful, how can he become more beautiful? If he's already unlimitedly in knowledge, how can he become more in knowledge? But Prabhupada specifically says, Krishna's energies and potencies are expanding, and then his knowledge expands to know how he's expanded, and then he expands more, but it's constant. You know, we're talking about, I was just listening to Prabhupada say, we talk about things chronologically, and say, this happens, then this happens, and this happens, but in regard to Krishna, it's not like that. So Krishna always knows the future. And what he knows is always correct. It's not like me, you know, I know this, and then I know this, and then I know this, and then I would say I'm wrong, and then I would know that. It's not like that. Yeah.
But if he knows us so well, doesn't he know the decisions that you're going to make over the next 40 years, then he knows?
Maybe. Do you have any ability to change yourself?
How can that make
sense? But that means he doesn't know you properly then.
We're a dynamic, free being also. We're free. Krishna is independent. He's Swaradam. We have a little independence. We really do. We really, really do have a little independence. Please, we really do. We're not robots. We're not some planned robot like that.
What if you can conceptualize it? Does that make us... It doesn't make us any less having free will. It's just that he's all... So all-knowing.
All right, if you want to understand it like that, that's okay. If that particular language works for you, that's all right. But please don't think that all the decisions that we're going to make for the next 40 years are already there. That's nonsense. We have freedom.
Can I just add, maybe one of the reasons why it's so difficult to absorb is because the fact that things can change according to our will now is really frightening. That actually we might have some kind of, control is the wrong word, but we can affect our own kind of future. Maybe we're not really...
That's a good point. I mean, perhaps this goes back to the original discussion that what we're trying to do is find a way to make decisions where everything always works out the way that we want. And maybe we feel more comfortable if there's some divine plan that has every single detail worked out and I just have to figure out where I fit into the piece.
Sorry, one other thing. The other thing about Krishna, I think that as far as Krishna consciousness is concerned, the fact that we can actually choose to be or not be Krishna conscious, that becomes really kind of just nullified if everything's already planned. I've always kind of thought that the whole point is that if you do desire deeply and more desire deeply to become Krishna conscious, well then things can happen. But if...
Yes. Things even materially you can choose between the modes. And just because you've chosen the mode of ignorance for the last 500 lifetimes doesn't mean that you're always going to choose the mode of ignorance. And it doesn't mean that, you know, when a situation is put in front of you that you're going to have to go by your inclinations. You can make a choice. But I think you're right. I think that part of the reason that we ask this is maybe that we're afraid that we do have that responsibility. Our freedom is very small, but it's real. I was just actually reading. I think it's 1637. It's 16 something, where Prabhupada, in the whole purport, just talks about freedom. He said that everything is based upon freedom, and he says there is an amazing sentence. He said that the devotee is not dependent on, in all respects. The devotee is free. So for a liberated means what? The simple word synonym for liberated is. Free. So liberated soul is free. A really nice example of this is when Krishna is talking to Rukmini, and Krishna is arguing with Rukmini, and she faints. She says, oh, you know, and then he revives her, and she said, oh, I thought you were going to leave me. He said, no, I just wanted to joke. So Krishna's intention was to joke, but Rukmini's fainting was still pleasing to him because it was a manifestation of love. It's not that it's all just scripted.
Krishna's neutral, but is he or can he be more favorable to his devotees?
Yes, that's Krishna, but the super soul is neutral. Because Krishna's favorable to his devotee, if you as his devotee want someone else to have devotional service, Krishna will follow that. He'll break into the person's karma and follow your desire to help that person.
I was going to just to reconfirm, because that's the new idea. So you're saying that we can't affect someone's karma materially,
no.
but we can spiritually.
Yes.
And when you say that to kind of have desire for their love of God,
yes.
In a sense you're saying to pray for them.
Maybe.
Or whatever. To just develop that hope and that aspiration that they develop.
Yeah, and not to just sit in your room and pray for people. It's not that you can just sit in your room and pray for people. You can hand them a plate of prasada. You can hand them a book. You can talk to them about Krishna. You can do something active besides just praying for them. Now, you don't want to hand them a book with like, oh, I hope this person doesn't become Krishna conscious. I mean, there should be some goodwill on there also.
I was
going to
say, I think this sort of subject is one of those things that with our human mind, we can't really perceive it, like the fact that Krishna has no beginning or end. Because everything in our life has a beginning and end.
Yes.
We can't.
But what happens, beginning and end is another really good example. Because if you say, okay, everything has an end, what's the first question you say beyond, what's the first thing you say? What's after the end? Suppose I say that all of existence has a limit. The first thing you're going to say is, what's on the other side? And if you say all of existence is unlimited, you say, well, how is that possible? How can things go on unlimitedly? And you just can't conceive it. So to say that Krishna knows the future and yet we're creating the future moment by moment, it's very hard for us to hold that. And we put our own abilities on that and say, well, wait, if I were to know the future and the future was changing moment by moment, that would mean I'd always be wrong instead of I'd always be right. You know, I can't even coordinate the work of 30 people for 6 hours a day perfectly. I can do it reasonably, but I can't do it perfectly. And the only way I could perfectly know what 30 people were going to do in the future would be have it scripted. I can't think of any other way to do it for myself, so it's hard for me to imagine that somebody else can do it. I mean, I don't know exactly how he does it. I know that he does it. I don't know how. Now, maybe somebody else could explain how he does it. But I know when Prabhupada was asked this question, this was how he explained it. He explained that Krishna can know it just like anybody can know it. He knows what are the reactions to people's activity. That was how Prabhupada explained it. Yes.
In response to people doubting Krishna's unlimited knowledge by saying, because how he explained maybe in 40 years he'll be able to know, he has the ability to know, but because he's given us free will and that independence, he's chosen.
No.
Or is it
no. It's that we are also free will living entities who are creating the future. Is the future 40 years from now already there? Yes, it is. And it's always changing. Krishna says it right in Bhagavad Gita. He says material nature is what? Endlessly mutable. It's always changing. Krishna does not say material nature is fixed and the future is all fixed and everything is determined. He says it's endlessly mutable. So he always knows it, and what he always knows is right, and what he always knows that's right is in a state of flux. I'm looking at the river, and I'm always seeing the river, and I see the river as it is, and as I'm seeing the river as it is, it's changing. And I'm always seeing it correctly. It's not that I'm always seeing it incorrectly because it's changing.
I'm just wondering then, if it's constantly changing, then Krishna says, I know all living beings, what does that have to mean?
He knows who we are, where we've been, he knows what our tendencies are, he knows what our weaknesses are. Yes, he does project what we're going to do.
It's a projection.
But it's always changing. Otherwise, how do you do you have to continue in the same tendencies that you've had in the past? Do you have the ability to choose how you are going to have tendencies? Can you choose that?
No, you're eternally silent. And the point is, in
well, that you can't change.
We have material nature trying to enjoy on ourselves.
Yeah.
The point is, we can't change because we are not free. We are free.
You're not free.
We understand that we're not free.
You're not free. So you can't decide.
We're trying to come here.
So you can't choose goodness or ignorance?
That's not the choice. The choice is, are we or are we not servants of Krishna? We're trying to pretend like we're not, but we are.
Okay.
So we are liberated by the truth that we are not free.
Okay.
That is the freedom.
All right, but I have some freedom. Can you choose goodness or ignorance?
That's within the confines of material.
Yes, it is within the confines of material nature, but can you choose that? If you've been in ignorance for the last 500 lifetimes, can you now choose to be in goodness?
I'm not saying.
So then your tendency's changed. You're still within the prison, but it's changed. You got moved to another cell. Yeah?
In answer to Sandy's question, can you say that that by Krishna's choice to give us free will?
No. No, you cannot. That sentence is makes no sense.
But do you not choose?
That sentence makes no sense.
Why?
We are part of Krishna. I wish I could remember the exact words that Prabhupada used to explain this. I was so happy when I heard this just recently, actually. If we didn't have free will, we wouldn't be alive. And Krishna would be, it would be a nonsensical thing to say that like Krishna had cut off a part of himself. We're not given free will. It is who we are. We are part of Krishna, and Krishna has free will. Therefore, we have free will. It's not something awarded to us. It is the essential aspect of being alive. The most essential feature of being alive is desire. There's nothing more intrinsic to being alive than to manifest in desire. It's not given to us. It is us.
I'm going back to the other thing about changing someone's spiritual karma. So
there's no spiritual karma.
Oh, sorry. No, not spiritual. There's spirituality then. So if you change someone's so you can change someone's spirituality in terms of if you help or aid in whichever way.
Then you change their material karma. Yes. Yes. If you help someone spiritually, you change their material karma. You can't change anyone's material karma materially. You can change someone's material karma spiritually.
And then that means that, that kind of brings together the other thing about how futures always change.
If I give you prasadam, that changes your material karma.
And that changes.
If I just give you a good job and I give you some ordinary food to eat and I help you move to your new apartment, I'm not changing your karma. I'm helping myself. I'm not helping you, actually. I'm helping me.
And that then ties into, if the future's always changing, let's just say I did some service for you and somehow that kind of brings in some element of mercy, then my future does change. And as that future changes, the Lord sees that and figures that in.
I think what you're saying is right. I want you to think of something else. Like, you know, when you go back to Godhead, is that fixed? Is that a fixed thing? Is it like predetermined when each of us is going to develop Krishna Prema?
It's predetermined when we enter the Mahasattva.
I certainly hope not.
Because they think it's Vishnu as he emanates. Some people who are close to material nature, because he has eternal associates, and then the ones who are being emanated are near the material nature, and so then they're attracted because of that. And it's predetermined.
No. We have an original relationship with Krishna. It's not that some people start off at the, you know, close to the goal and other people are a billion miles away at the starting gate. No, it's not. Okay, so let's just give a simple example. So I have so much different actions and reactions from my karma, alright? And those actions and reactions involve other living beings. Does that make sense? So I've done something to Mr. Joe, and because of that, Mr. Joe is going to do something back to me in three lifetimes. Right? And I did something nice to Sammy, and I did something mean to Sally, and I gave this person money, and I didn't give her... I've done all these things, and so there's all these intricate reactions that are going to happen. Okay? Then somehow or other, I meet a pure devotee, and I fall in love with Krishna, and now I'm out of here. Well, what happened to all that stuff? Or maybe I meet a pure devotee, and it takes me 10 lifetimes to get out of here. Maybe it takes me one lifetime. What happened to all that stuff? Had to what? It had to shift, didn't it? Do we say that we're shifting people's karma by giving them Krishna consciousness? Well, now that's interesting, isn't it? But Krishna already knew we were going to give him. We actually have the ability to say, I want to give someone Krishna consciousness. We have that ability. We have the ability, yeah, I know. We have the ability to move within the mode, and we have the ability to surrender to Krishna. We really, 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 really do. We really do. And if you want to say Krishna already knows exactly when we're going to do that, okay, I know. I'll buy that. That's not the language I would use for myself, but, you know, that'll work. If you want to say that Krishna already knows exactly what people are going to do because he knows them so well, okay, fine. But still, the future's always shifting. You know? However you want to explain it, material nature is still endlessly mutable. And taking up Krishna consciousness is free. Prabhupada says it's free. Specifically says that in that purport. It's free. He said one may have the opportunity and not take it, or one may, you know, it's not something predetermined. That depends on us. So if you want to say that Krishna understands each of our freedoms so well that he knows exactly how we're going to exercise our freedom under all situations, you know, okay. There's more than one way of explaining the same thing. But if you want to say that every single detail of the future is already known in advance forever and it doesn't change, that's absurd. That doesn't comport with anything else. Does that make sense? You cannot say that the future is absolutely fixed in every detail and is not subject to change. That nobody could ever go back to Godhead unless that was scripted. In that case, it's not free. And we know that it's free. You've got to say that, you've got to at least admit that we have free will to choose Krishna and Maya. I mean, come on, you're not going to tell me we don't at least have that kind of free will. As soon as somebody chooses Krishna, everything shifts. It has to. Doesn't it?
Well, you get Nitya Bhattas who stay in the Mahatattva forever. Maybe Krishna can just be it. Just because he was beyond our conception. Just as he can.
Well, I'll tell you what. At some point when you see how all this works, you can come back and tell us exactly how it works. And I would guess that when you do that, that number one, you would have a very hard time putting it into words.
Maybe you could tell me.
I would guess number one, you'd have a very hard time putting it into words. I would guess number two, that the different people who would hear you would all interpret it and understand it somewhat differently. And you know what? It's okay. That's okay. We don't have to all explain. Krishna explains this to Uddhava in the 11th canto. It's not necessary that each of us explain the same truth exactly the same way, and it's not necessary that each of us understand it in exactly the same way. As long as you're happy that we have free will, and as long as you're happy that Krishna knows the future, how exactly you put those two things together can really matter. But if you start doubting that maybe Krishna's really a dummy because we have free will, or if you're doubting maybe we're really just a bunch of robots because Krishna knows the future, then we have a problem. Okay? But however it makes sense to you and you're happy with it, as long as it's supportable by Shastra, it's really... We don't all have to understand it in the same language. That's not necessary. The pure devotees in Goloka Vrindavan don't understand everything exactly the same way. It's not that when we're liberated souls that all of us will just, you know, be reciting everything in unison like a parrot in the same language with the same realization. That's not a fact. When Gopakumar goes to Vaikuntha, he's seeing Lord Vishnu and he's calling Lord Vishnu Gopal. Saying, hey Gopal. So some of the residents of Vaikuntha get very upset. And they say, you can't call Lord Vishnu Gopal. I mean, yes, that's one of his incarnations. They see Vishnu as the source of Krishna. They say, yes, that's one of Vishnu's incarnations. And yes, he plays as Gopal, but that's not really a respectful way to talk about him here in Vaikuntha. And, you know, that's just one of his pastimes. You can't do that. And some of the other residents of Vaikuntha say, no, it's perfectly correct. You can call Lord Vishnu by the names of any of his incarnations. Even there, they're not saying Krishna is the source of Vishnu. They're saying Vishnu is the source of Krishna. So how is that? How is it that two different groups of residents of Vaikuntha have two different opinions? And how is it that the residents of Vaikuntha see things differently than the residents of Vrindavan? They know everything. Ah. How is that? You know, or that Krishna is in Vrindavan, and, you know, Krishna goes to sleep at night, or he seems like he goes to sleep at night, but he doesn't really. He gets out and he goes out in the forest and dilly-dallies with the gopis. And then he comes back early in the morning and he just kind of gets into bed at the last minute and pretends to be sleeping. And Mother Yasoda comes and wakes him up, and she sees that he's kind of dirty. And his clothes are sort of disheveled and, you know. And she says, hey, he didn't get a proper bath last night. Those servants who didn't bathe him properly, you know. And why does he have Balaram's cloth on? He doesn't have Balaram's cloth, he has Radharani's cloth. But she says, why does he have Balaram's cloth? And some of the other gopis were there, they start giggling. And they think, oh, you don't know what's actually happened. So Mother Yasoda is a liberated soul, she has full knowledge. Why doesn't she know what Krishna does? How come how Mother Yasoda is seeing Krishna in the morning is different from the way the gopis are seeing Krishna in the morning? How is that? Why don't they have exactly the same vision? Why don't they describe reality in exactly the same way? Mother Yasoda's thinking Krishna's just my little boy. He's not old enough to be interested in girls yet, he's just a little boy. That's how she's perceiving him. But we don't all have to perceive the absolute truth in exactly this. This is not, we're individuals. Truth isn't just something, you know, It's not that Prabhupada explained things exactly the same way as Bhaktivinoda Thakur in exactly the same language. Okay? Yeah. I mean, even before liberation, we have different viewpoints and we have different ways of understanding things. And the way that I understand things may not be that way, just doesn't click for you. Okay, that's all right. It's not that if it doesn't, that you're in Maya because you don't see things my way. Or I'm in Maya because I don't see things your way. As long as they're supported by Shastra, they're within the process. There's a certain limit, but within that limit, there's a lot of freedom. Yes? Isn't that an interesting question? How can there be one absolute truth if everyone perceives it differently? All right, well, there's a pillar right there. There's one pillar. And I tell you, how I'm seeing the pillar is not the same way you're seeing the pillar. Does that mean it's subjective? It's dependent on our positions in the room, isn't it? Is the way you're seeing the pillar truth? Is it true or is it subjective? It's true. It's partial. We never know Krishna fully. Prabhupada says it all the time. He says no one ever knows Krishna fully. But we enjoy trying to know him. That's what Prabhupada said. It's very pleasurable to try to know Krishna. You can't know Krishna. I can't know Krishna fully. You can't know Krishna fully. And when people are really in love with Krishna, they don't see Krishna objectively at all. But truth doesn't mean that you know every single little detail. It just means that what you know is true. You know him for who he is. Okay? But no, you're never going to know him completely. And please tell me, what's more true? I love doing these things to people. What's more true? That Nanda Maharaj is Krishna's father or that Nanda Maharaj is Krishna's son? What's more true? Can you answer that question? No. That's an unanswerable question. From the point of view of tattva, Nanda Maharaj is Krishna's son. From the point of view of rasa, Nanda Maharaj is Krishna's father. Now, what's more true? Well, you could say tattva is more objective. So that's more true. You could say rasa is more pleasing to Krishna, and truth is what pleases Krishna the most, so rasa is more true. Is there an answer to that question? It depends what you're doing. What, you know, what's your mood at the time? Who you're talking to? What's the point you're trying to make? Mother Yasoda looks in Krishna's mouth and she says, "Oh, I've been an illusion. I thought Nanda Maharaj was my husband and Krishna was my son and all this property belonged to me. I was completely an illusion," right? You know, right? She says that. But what is the highest reality? That Nanda Maharaj is her husband and Krishna is her son. We can say, well, that's not tattva, that's yoga maya. But isn't yoga maya the ultimate truth? So we're the only place you're going to find just stark objective truth. You know, talking about understanding Krishna. In what form of Krishna is he dealing with just stark objective truth? Paramatma. As Paramatma, Krishna is just dealing with stark, objective truth. But otherwise, he's dealing with rasa. Not just dealing with tattva, he's dealing with rasa, he's dealing with relationships. He's a fun guy. He's not just like some boring mathematician, you know. He's fun. So, you know, you can understand Krishna through some objective process, that's fine. But the other understanding is also there. Yeah.
It's kind of like that story with the blind man and the elephant, where they're all feeling a different part, but
sort of.
They're explaining.
Sort of, because that's talking about imperfect knowledge. Whereas Mother Yasoda's knowledge of Krishna is not imperfect.
I mean, about the absolute truth.
That we're seeing from different angles of vision? Well, but see, there, to some extent. But it's not that Mother Yasoda's view is not truth. Mother Yasoda's view of Krishna is perfect truth.
Well, of each of what they're saying, it's also true, but they think that theirs is the only truth.
Well, I think your example is much more talking about neophyte devotees in different religions. rather than very exalted, liberated person. I wouldn't. I think that example applies to, like, you know, the neophyte Muslim thinks that his is the only way and everyone else should be killed, and the neophyte born-again thinks that his is the only way and everyone else is going to hell, and, you know, maybe the neophyte Hare Krishna devotee thinks that way too, I don't know. But that's much more like that, where I think, you know, the elephant is a pillar, and if you say the elephant is a fan, then you're in illusion and you're going to hell. That's more that. It's different. That's illusion. Alright, well, I understand we're all too sentichai or manticai talking about Krishna's inconceivable potency, but I'm going to get in trouble for it. I'm already getting in trouble for going over time. And I'm sorry that it is impossible to fully understand Krishna with the mind and the senses in a way that is totally intellectually satisfying on all levels at all times. That's not going to happen. And if it did, wouldn't he be awfully boring? I really think that he would be awfully boring. Right? Lord Brahma's a lot smarter than we are, and he says, you know, some people, Krishna, say they can understand you. He said, I don't know about them, but I just offer my obeisances. So it's very nice to talk about these things about Krishna. It's very enlivening. That's part of our process. But please don't think you're going to come to some answer by which you're going to understand everything about Krishna fully, as if he were some, you know, bug you can put under a microscope and understand. Is that all right?
Yeah.
Is that all right?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. All glories to girls.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.